mitzvah of honor and the mitzvah of fear or reverence of the parent. Right, so we are in effect continuing that subject, and we will see a conversation between a father and a son, or a son and a father actually, and we'll have to draw certain conclusions, or we'll wonder about what conclusions can be drawn from this conversation. Matme le Rav Yechezkel Rami Barei. Rav Yechezkel taught his son Rami a Mishnah from Sanhedrin. And the Mishnah goes like this. Hanisrafim baniskalin Rabbi Shimon Omer Yidon ubiskila shesrefa chamura. Okay? This is a Mishnah in Masechet Sanhedrin. Masechet Sanhedrin deals with issues of the court, and among the issues that are discussed in the tractate are the laws of capital punishment. Okay? Now, in Judaism, there is capital punishment for a variety of infractions. And if one is to receive a capital penalty, there are actually a variety of such possible penalties. In the Torah, it's not just death, but depends on how you die. So there are deaths and there are deaths. There are better and worse ways to die. Now, do you remember the forms of the death penalty? Mm-hmm. Skila, Sreifa, Hereg, Vechenek. Right? Skila, Sreifa, Hereg, Vechenek.
You
don't know it from Yom Kippur. Right. Exactly. In the Yom Kippur liturgy, this is repeated at the end of the Amida. Skila, Sreifa, Hereg, Vechenek. And skila is stoning. Sreifa is burning. Now, just to take those two, in the Talmud, it doesn't mean what you think. Stoning does not mean stoning. It just says stoning. Stoning means getting pushed off a cliff.
We discussed it with the doctor.
And sreifa doesn't mean burning with a fire. It means drinking molten lead. It's a wonderful way to go. Hereg is saif. That's the guillotine. That's a sword. And chenek is choking. And what they would do there is you would take a rope or a long piece of cloth, wrap it around somebody's neck, pull from one side, pull from the other side. So it's very gruesome. Very gruesome, no doubt about it. But the question is, which of these is more gruesome than the other? And on that, of course, is a disagreement in the Talmud.
Molten lead. I mean, this group went crazy with molten lead.
Well, you could see that your immediate reaction was strongest for molten lead.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
And you will see that there is much precedent for that reaction.
Lead is the poison.
Forget the poison. Even if it were not poisonous, it would not be pleasant.
Don't worry about that.
Okay. Well, let's say if the heat doesn't get you, the poison will, but it's going to get you. So now, Rav Yechezkel teaches his son, the Mishnah in Sanhedrin, and he teaches it in the following way. Anisrafim baniskalin. Right? If you have two different groups of criminals, one has committed crimes for which they get sreifa. The other one commits crimes that they get skila. Okay? Sreifa burning, skila stoning. Interpreted as I said to you before. Okay, so you have these two different groups. One group gets mixed up in the other group. All right? And they don't know who is who. So what do we do then? Do we give them all skila or do we give them all sreifa? Okay? So as you would imagine, what would you do in that circumstance? You know, if you have two groups, some of which are subject to the more extreme penalty, some to the less extreme penalty, well, the logical thing is that everybody should become subject to the less extreme penalty. Okay? That seems to be what one would expect. And here you have it. Hanisrafim maniskalin. If those who are supposed to get srefa are mixed up with those who are supposed to get skila, Rabbi Shimon Omer, Rabbi Shimon says, Yidonu biskila, shahasrefa chamura. They all should be judged finally to get skila, because srefa is the more severe penalty. Okay? So in other words, when in doubt, you give people the less severe penalty. And you would be in doubt if two groups of people got mixed in with each other. Yes, sir?
Does it mean people get mixed up, or does it mean if you've committed two crimes and one would result in you being subject to srefa and one to skila, that in effect you get to suffer the least?
That's a separate issue. That is a reasonable issue, and indeed that is an issue that one would have to adjudicate on. But this particular mission is referring to the first of your possibilities, which is that two different groups of people get mixed up together.
I mean, there were cases where there were so many people at one time getting cattle crop.
Well, let's say there were more than two. Let's say there were more than two.
I can see it Roman times. Under Judaic law, I can't.
Well, first of all, you're quite right. There's no reason to assume that there's any reality behind this. In truth, when you read the laws of Sanhedrin, you have to keep in mind that the Sanhedrin and all the duties of the Sanhedrin and all the penalties of the court really didn't function, because this took place during Roman times. And during Roman times, the rabbinic courts had no powers to, in fact, give these penalties. So, indeed, it's a good observation to make, because what you're seeing here are reflections rather than the records of court cases in these particular cases. Okay? So, in fact, if you think to yourself, one group gets involved with another group, you raise a decent objection. How many people were there? I'll raise yet another objection. So, if you went to a guy, you wouldn't know who was supposed to get what? I mean, there was a judge, there was a court, and a court, not only a judge, it was a court of 72. And, they didn't know what was going on. Of course they knew what was going on. So, in fact, the reality here are weak. But I don't think it has anything to do with reality. It has to do, rather, with a speculation on the application of the law. Okay? Yes?
What does this have to do with honoring your mother and father?
So far, nothing.
Thank you.
But,
that was my question.
But you could bet that if you had patience, you'll get down and you'll see that it has something to do with it. Okay? So this is the father teaches the Mishnah to the son. Now keep in mind that the Mishnah is oral teaching. Okay? We have a written Mishnah. But they didn't have a written Mishnah. During the times of the Mishnah itself, until the Mishnah was codified in the year 200, the Mishnah was not written down. Or if it was written down, may have been written down, but it didn't have any sanctity in its written form. In fact, it was taught. And this was the law as it was understood, and it was taught in a certain form. So here's the father teaching it to the son. Now, Amar lei Rav Yehuda berei. Rav Yehuda is the son. So the son then says to the father, Abba, lo titnaya hachi. Father, do not teach the Mishnah that way. Oho, now we have an issue. And the issue is, should the son have said that to the father? Should the son say to the... We already learned that a son shouldn't make decisions or participate in the making of decisions in the presence of the father. Now here the son is disagreeing with the father, and disagreeing in a certain way. You know with your children, there is a way that you're not offended when they disagree with you, and there is a way that you are offended when they disagree with you. The fact is that sooner or later they'll disagree with you. But if they're going to do it, they should at least do it in an appropriate and an honorable fashion. So that's what we're really dealing with here. So the son says to the father, Abba, lo titnaya hachi, al tishneta mishna kacha. Right? Don't teach the Mishnah that way. right? And the son has a logical critique of the way the father formulated the Mishnah. It goes like this. My ir yisrefa chamura. If the Mishnah reads the way you just recited it, why does it matter that srefa is more painful than skila? Tipok li derubab niskalin ninhu. You can derive that just from the fact that the majority must have been those who were supposed to get skila, because the formulation of the Mishnah is hanisrafim. When some who are supposed to get srefa are mixed in with those who are to get skila, and the formulation of the Mishnah is such that a convention of such a formulation is that the smaller amount is mixed into the larger amount. That's just the way the Mishnah usually formulates things. So in other words, given that fact, the smaller amount would be first, namely the Nisrafim, those who are supposed to get Srefa. The larger amount would be the Skila people, the people who are supposed to be stoned. Okay? So he says to his father, "My Irya Srefa Chamura." What difference does it make that Srefa is the more stringent of the penalties? Tipokli deruba di skila ninhu. You can draw the conclusion without that piece of knowledge. Namely, when you have a mixture of two different types, what governs? The majority governs. So if you have two of one type and one of another type, and you have to make a determination, it will always go according to the one that has the larger number. So the son is then saying to the father, you have formulated the Mishnah incorrectly. You formulated it incorrectly. Because if you formulated it correctly, then Rabbi Shimon's comment is irrelevant. It's irrelevant because it doesn't really make any difference whether one is more stringent than the other. Simply, the way you formulated it is that the minority is put into the majority. Of course the majority will rule. The majority is the Skila people. Right, hanisrafim basniskalin, the ones who are supposed to get srefa mixed in with the ones who are supposed to get skila. So it doesn't really matter which one is more stringent. It's a question of majority and minority. So he goes on. Next page. Elahachi itnaya, but rather teach it in the following way, because he's confident that Rabbi Shimon's comment belongs there. You have to teach it the opposite direction, namely, haniskalin banisrafim. If those who are supposed to get stoned are mixed in with those who are supposed to get burned, which is the majority? The burned crew, okay? So then it would go according to the majority, that would be the srefa, the ones who are supposed to get burned. So in that case, Rabbi Shimon's comment makes sense. Because Rabbi Shimon's comment is, no, it goes according to those who are supposed to get stoned. Why? Because stoning is the less stringent penalty. So he simply turns around his father's formulation of the Mishnah based on the logic of the thing. Based on the logic. All right. Amar Lei, Rabbi Cheskel then says to his son, Ihache, if you are right, you can't base what you are saying simply on what I taught you so far. You have to remember the end of the Mishnah. The end of the Mishnah goes on as follows. V'chachamim omrim, and the sages say, Yidonu b'sreifa shehaskila chamura. The sages say, no, they should be judged as all of sreifa, burning, because skila, stoning, is the more stringent. So the sages have exactly the opposite point of view from Rabbi Shimon. Was that Shimon? I think it was Rabbi Shimon. Is that right? Yep, from Rabbi Shimon. Sages have exactly the opposite point of view. Rabbi Shimon says that srefa is the more stringent. The sages say skila is the more stringent. Okay? Now, with the original way that the father taught the Mishnah, that's fine. because there's a difference of opinion, and although what the son said about the first half makes sense, in fact, the structure of the Mishnah is determined not necessarily by the point of view of Rabbi Shimon, but by the point of view of the sages. And the sages believed that Skila was the more stringent. Therefore, the original way that the Mishnah was stated by the father makes sense. Because, remember, it was the people from Sreifa who got involved with the people from Skila. Right? And it goes toward Sreifa. Okay. So, that having been said, then the Chachamim say, my area de Skila Chamura, Tipokli, the Roban Israfim Ninhu. If I now take your formulation of the Mishnah, the sage's point of view doesn't make sense. Right? Just what I said, not to dwell on it too much, because the details aren't all that important, since we have to see where we're going. Amar le hatam rabbanan hu deka amru le l'rabbi Shimon. There in the latter part of the Mishnah, the sages are responding to the argument of Rabbi Shimon as follows. They're not really commenting on the first part of the Mishnah, they're just commenting upon Rabbi Shimon. So this is the son saying that. So therefore my original formulation, my original critique of your Mishnah, the way you taught it, it still stands. The father says, no, look at the end of the Mishnah. It affects the way you interpret it. You didn't read the whole Mishnah. But the point is that the son disagreed so strongly with the father. Okay? Amar le Shmuel Rav Yehuda. Shmuel says to Rav Yehuda. Now, Rav Yehuda is the son who disagreed with the father. So Shmuel says to the son, Shinana lo tema leila avuchachi. Shop one. Shinana is a way that the rabbis sometimes address each other. It comes from the word shen, teeth. So shinana is a way of saying to somebody, you're a very sharp guy. Namely, your thinking is very sharp. You are very sharp in the way you analyze the Mishnah. Okay, big shot. And there is a little edge to this as well when he says Shinana. All right, big shot. All right, Shinana lo te male la vuchachi. You're very smart, but you shouldn't talk to your father that way. You shouldn't talk to your father that way. Ditanya, because it is taught in the Baraita, hare shahaya aviv over al divrei Torah. It's a very interesting issue, particularly relevant in modern times. If a person's father were to transgress the Torah, al yomarlo, the son should not say to the father, Abba, avarta al divrei Torah. Abba, you have trespassed the ways of the Torah. Ela omerlo, rather he says to him, Abba, kach katu b'Torah. This is what is written in the Torah. You understand the subtle difference here? You don't say to your father he's wrong. Right? It's simply not nice to, in front of your father, toward your father, draw that conclusion. Instead, you say, this is what's written in the Torah, and you leave it to your father to draw the conclusion. Right? But the Gemara goes on and says, Kach katu b'Torah, Sa'ure kametzare le. You think that isn't going to pain him? All right, if you tell your father, this is what's written in the Torah, you don't think that's going to hurt him? Of course it's going to hurt him. Ela omerlo, so the Gemara revises what the son should say somewhat. Abra mikra katuv batorah kach. The scripture is written in such a way. In other words, it softens it a little bit. It simply, instead of saying, this is what's written, that's a way of saying, you know, you don't know the Torah, don't you remember what's written there? So you soften it a little and you say, the scripture is written reads as follows. Just to make a sort of general comment on the scriptures, as opposed to making it more pointed and more directed at the father. Okay? So you see now that what we are dealing with here it was a rather abstruse introduction, there's no doubt about it. But the purpose of all of that was to bring us to this sense that you have to watch out how you correct the parent. It may be that you should correct the parent. We're not saying you can't correct the parent, but you have to do it in a way that's benign.
You started out by saying that the commandment was to fear or to revere the parent.
Right.
Is it fear or revere?
I don't know. It's both.
Big difference.
Yep, but it's both. Because in English, the two are so separate that we have to say there's a big difference. In the Hebrew, we just can't make that distinction. We just can't make that distinction. So it does involve reverence, and it does involve a sense of fear, that there are places where you shouldn't walk, you shouldn't go, things that you shouldn't say, and it's all right to be fearful of that. That doesn't necessarily imply punishment. I don't think that's what we're talking about here. But it does involve a, let's say, high degree of anxiety. Okay? Anybody else? Okay. Elazar ben Matya Omer. We're going on now with the same subject. Elazar, the son of Matya, says, Abba Omer Hashkeni Mayim. Abba says, give me a drink of water. Umitzvah lasot. But the guy has a mitzvah that he's supposed to do. Right? He didn't put on his tefillin yet. He didn't go daven. So the question is, which takes precedence? Does he answer his father? And of course, the father's command is not the word of God. The father says, give me a drink of water. That's not God speaking, but God does say that you are supposed to revere and honor the parent. And we know that one of the ways of honoring a parent is to give him food and drink. Okay? So we have a conflict now of two different things. The Baraita goes on and says, Maniach ani kavod Abba. I leave the honor of Abba, v'oseh et ha-mitzvah, and do the mitzvah. She'ani v'Abba chayavim ba-mitzvah, because both Abba and I are obligated to perform the mitzvah. So in other words, this is a matter of logic, he says, that since the mitzvah is something that both of us are obligated to do, and the obligation to honor the parent is something that only one person is obligated to do, obviously the mitzvah must be something that is yet more important. Okay? But that's not all that obvious, because now there's a dissent. Isi ben Yehuda Omer, Isi ben Yehuda says, Im efshar la mitzvah le'asot al yaday acherim, it could be that the mitzvah could be done by other people. It depends. You know, a mitzvah is not a mitzvah. Every mitzvah is different. Some mitzvot, let's say you have a mitzvah to help somebody. Well, maybe somebody else could help that person. So you can't just say because it's a mitzvah it should take precedence. Some mitzvot might be doable by other people. And then, since somebody else could perform that mitzvah, let him be concerned with his father's honor. It also could be, there's another way of looking at it, and that is that the mitzvah, not all mitzvot, have to be done on time. There's a certain flexibility of the time parameters. You're supposed to say shacharit at a certain early hour. But what happens if you don't say it at an early hour? So you do it at another hour. There's a point after which you may not be able to do it, but we're not necessarily, you know, that doesn't necessarily kick in. It could be that the time still is flexible. If your mitzvah is to give tzedakah, yes, you should be giving tzedakah, and you should give tzedakah sooner than later. But you could give it later. So that we can't always say that a mitzvah that should be done has to be done right now. So that's the view of Isi ben Yehuda. Isi ben Yehuda says that, in fact, the parent takes precedence over the mitzvah. Because I think that probably our intuitive sense was that the mitzvah should take precedence over the parent. This is Ben Yehuda says no. And then the Gemara says, Amar Rav Nachma halacha ke Isi ben Yehuda. The law goes according to Isi ben Yehuda. So interestingly enough then, the law does go according to Isi ben Yehuda. When there is a conflict, in most cases, not all cases, but most cases, it goes toward the parent and not toward the doing of the mitzvah. Okay? Now we go on. Amar Rav Yitzchak bar Shela, Amar Rav Matna bar Rav Chisda. Related issue. It's not exactly the same issue, but it's related. Ha'av shamachal al kvodo. If a father renounces the honor due to him, if he is willing to forgo his honor, kvodo machul, his honor should be forgone. So in other words, you can say, if you are a person who is due honor, at least the parent can say, no, you don't have to do that. You don't have to do that. That's not a small issue, because given the scope of the mitzvot, as we read them last time, the scope of the mitzvot of kibud, and we were talking about that, you know, what if a person doesn't want it? What if a parent really would feel better to have somebody else take care of them than their child? Well, that's perfectly fine, because we see that a parent is able to forgo the honor that is supposed to be coming to him. That's permissible. Av shemachal al kvodo, kvodo machul. Harav shemachal al kvodo, but the teacher who forgoes his honor, ein kvodo machul. His honor cannot be forgotten.
Unless somebody is his son.
Well, that would be a question. I'm not sure about that. Well, we might have to ask that question. But I'm not sure we'll come to this conclusion. We just sort of write this. So let's see where we go with this. But let's think of the logic behind it. Why is there a difference between the father and the teacher? What's the difference?
The teacher would be standing in for God.
Correct. Because the teacher, in fact, doesn't have a relationship that is responsible, as the father and the son have a relationship that's responsible for the obligation, but rather the teacher simply is a stand-in for the Torah, which is to say for God. The teacher derives his significance and the reason to honor him not because of the relationship to the student, but because of God and the Torah that God, that he has in his possession. Okay? But, you thought that was easy? It's not easy. V'Rav Yosef Amar, Rav Yosef says, Afilu harav shemachal al kvodo. Even the rabbi or the teacher who forgoes his honor, kvodo machol. His honor is forgotten. So it's permissible for the teacher. Shenemar v'Hashem holech lifneihem yomam. Because it says, Hashem went before them by day. Now, if you were really honored, do you think you would necessarily go first in the army? The one who is honored, you put in the front of the army the privates. You don't put the general in the front of the army, you put the general in the back of the army. Right, but where does the general go? God is the general? Goes in the front of the army. So, obviously, God was willing to forgo his honor. So, if God is willing to forgo his honor, the Torah says that he went in the front, he forgoes his honor. If God could forgo his honor, then obviously the teacher can forgo his honor. Good argument. It's a good argument. It's interesting that the example is God. And scripture says that God forgoes his honor. Amar Rava Hachi Hashta. Well, if that's so, Hatam HaKadosh Baruch Hu, there we're talking about the Holy One, blessed be He, about God. Alma Delay. And God is different from the teacher. How? Alma Delay. HaOlam Shelo. the whole world is his. Vitaradile, and the whole Torah is his. Mechile liyakare, so he can renounce his honor. God owns everything. But the scholar doesn't own the Torah. Right? The scholar is simply the beneficiary of the Torah. But God is not the beneficiary of the Torah. God is not even the beneficiary of God. Guess what? God is God. Right? Since God is God, he owns everything. So that you can't make an analogy between the two. God can forgo the honor, and reasonably then, the scholar can't forgo the honor. Here, however, in the case of the teacher, the Torah is his. And he can't renounce it. Hadar Amarava Rava then says, Ein Torah di'in, in Torah di'lehi. Yes, the Torah does belong to the teacher. Just as the world belongs to God, and the Torah belongs to God, so does the Torah belong to the teacher. Dichtiv, as it is written, Uve Torato Yege Yomam Balaila. And his Torah, we always read that as meaning God's Torah, he shall study day and night. But the truth is, what you study day and night is your Torah. When you review a lesson, all right, among the things that you are doing when you review a lesson is that you're reviewing your Torah. You come to possess it, and then it becomes your own. Becomes your own Torah. And therefore, in fact, when it says, Uve Torah Toya Geyoman Balayla, his Torah he shall study day and night, he actually has possession of it. And it is his. Don't say it's not his, it's only God's. The scholar comes to possess the Torah. It's a nice idea. A nice idea. Well, but there's an objection. Eini, and is that so? V'harava mashke be'ilule difrei. Okay, so now we are learning that the scholar has the right to forego his honor. And that would be the conclusion that we've... If the Torah is in the possession, the Torah is owned by the scholar, then just as God can forego his honor, the scholar can forego his honor. So then the Gemara says, but don't you remember these following stories? And we'll see whether the scholar in fact forgoes his honor. Can forego his honor. Harava mashke behilule divrei. Remember the story about Rava, who was serving drinks at the wedding celebration of his son. Now the fact that the rabbi is serving drinks, he's the bartender, as it were. They didn't have a bartender, but you know, he's pouring the wine, going around the tables pouring the wine. Is that something that a general, a king, a rabbi should do? Somebody should pour the rabbi's wine. The rabbi shouldn't pour other people's wine. So obviously, if the rabbi is pouring other people's wine, he is forgoing his honor. He is forgoing his honor. V'dale knasel rav papel rav hune bered rav Yehoshua. When he offered a cup to Rav Papa and Rav Huna, the son of Rav Yehoshua, kamu v'kamu mikame, they stood up in front of him. Because we will learn that is the obligation of the student to stand up in front of the teacher, to show honor, to pay respect to the teacher. And again, not to the teacher so much as to the Torah of the teacher. All right. So on the one hand, the rabbi is forgoing his honor. The student still has the option of standing up in front of the rabbi, even though the rabbi has decided to forego the honor. So these students do stand up. All right, so v'kamu mikame. L'rav Mari u'l'rav Pinchas b'rei d'rav Chista, when he goes and he serves these other two rabbis then, lo kamu mikame, they didn't get up. They didn't get up. Ikpat, and he got mad. Oh, he got mad. So here's the problem. If he was forgoing his honor, we said that's okay. But then, why would he get mad? If he's forgoing his honor, he's forgoing his honor. So, in fact, maybe what we are learning here is that he can't forego his honor, because otherwise he wouldn't have gotten mad. Right? He would have enough self-control to not get mad when he shouldn't be getting mad. He knows the halacha. Hanu rabbanan. Ikpad v'amar. He gets mad and he says, Hanu rabbanan rabbanan. These rabbis are rabbis. In other words, ones who stood up. Vanu rabbanan lav rabbanan. And those rabbis are not rabbis. Right? So in other words, he condemns the ones who didn't stand up. Okay? Vitu, moreover, we have another story. Rav Papa Havamashke Behilul Diaba, Diaba Marbare. Rav Papa was similarly serving the drinks, pouring the wine, at the wedding celebration for Abba Mar. His son's name was Abba Mar. Okay, so it's a similar situation. Vidale le kasa le Rabbi Yitzchak bere de Rabbi Yehuda. And he pours the cup then for Rabbi Yitzchak, the son of Rabbi Yehuda. Velo kam mikame. And that rabbi doesn't get up. He doesn't stand up. Ve'ikpat. And he got mad. The rabbi gets mad. So again, we see these two circumstances where on the one hand, the rabbi seems to be foregoing his respect that's due to him, and yet he gets mad. So apparently then, even if you forego it, you don't forego it. Because a student is supposed to know that even if you act as if you're foregoing the honor due to you, the student is not allowed to forego that honor. Okay, that's the law apparently. So then the Gemara finally concludes, Afilu hachi hidur me'abad le'bao. Well, it could be that in fact you can forgo your honor, mostly. But if the rabbi forgoes his honor, it's permissible for the students also to not honor the rabbi in the normal fashion. But the least they should do is something. Hidur, and you'll see, we'll read this further on in the Gemara, Hidur refers to a very minimal bow. In other words, the students should go like this. They should have bowed forward. So they didn't have to stand up. But they should at least have the good sense to do something rather than nothing. So we have learned from this then that in fact the rabbi can forego the honor that is due to him, but there's a certain level of manners. And even when people forego the honor due to them, still it doesn't end the situation. There's still an issue of manners here. And those who are the recipients, let's say, of the honor that has been foregone, still, they should act in an appropriate and in a mannerful fashion.
So how was that handled at JTS by the professor who opened the door for the students?
So the way it's, when this happens, what usually happens is that you make a fuss. You know, the student says, since somehow acknowledges that this is not normal behavior. So that's the idea. You can't just take it as if it's normal. Okay? In effect, you have to have some response to it which acknowledges the fact that this is something unusual. And that acknowledgement is its own form of honor. Okay? Even though it's not the halachically required form of honor where honor is due.
What about thank you? Just admitting thank you, saying thank you.
Probably that's not enough, because that is required of everybody. Okay. And here, there is a sense that some people require a level of deference which goes beyond what everybody requires. Okay?
Even when he is mochel al kvodo.
Even mochel al kvodo, if he is the rav.
Because he put himself in the level of the ordinary.
Correct. The problem with the Rav, remember, is that the Rav really this issue that we confronted before is an issue. That is to say that the Rav deserves honor not because of his relation so much to the student, but because of his relation to the Torah. Because he is representing the Torah, the student is honoring not the person, but the Torah.
So that's the function rather than...
Well, the function, you could say a function. Okay.
Isn't there a lack of rigor in the use of the term honor here? Didn't we learn that honoring your father, wasn't that the one that was related to material support?
Mm-hmm.
And here we're using it in the more traditional way of honor.
That's a good point, because realize we've shifted the discussion somewhat, because we're not really talking here about the honor of the parent, but we're talking about the honor of the rabbi.
Yeah.
Okay? So your observation is correct. And as you will see, the Gemara is going to, in fact, make a transition a little further on. And you will see that this idea of honor comes from a different verse. The first honor that we've been dealing with comes from the verse of Kibud Av V'Em. Right. But this is actually different. This is different. Because it's not honor so much. The first one, remember, was Yirah.
Right.
It was fear or awe, as, you know, however we want to translate that. But here we've introduced another concept, which is honor, per se. And that comes from a different verse. Okay? Yes?
There is a modern trend, particularly this country, of many parents saying, I do not want to become a burden to my children when I get old.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that is, of course, giving up the honor.
Correct. And because, remember, the first thing that we saw is that av shemochel al kvodo kvodo machu, that the parent who foregoes the honor, that honor is forgone. So the parent is relatively easy. It's more complicated when we go from the parent to the teacher.
I have to disagree with that. I think the purpose of most parents saying that is to preserve their honor. They don't want to become in a situation where they need to be supported or helped. They're trying to. They would prefer to be able to deal with things on their own. So I can't say that it's somebody voluntarily giving up the honor by saying that.
I mean, I in my mind would classify it a different honor.
Yeah,
well, that's what you're doing. Right, right. Yes?
In the text, in the first paragraph that we involving Rava, the first group, the first two, Rav Papa and Rav Huna, do stand up and do pay respects to Rava. I was wondering why that might be in there. Does it contrast with those that didn't? Does it does it make it, for example, maybe Rava gets particularly upset because mm-hmm. he sees appropriate what he thinks appropriate behavior?
Yeah, I think that's a good conclusion. I think that the structure, the literary structure of it, is that you see something, and in a way, it's also surprising because. Because the rabbi is serving the drinks, in a way, it's surprising to see that the students do this, because he's already announced by what he's doing that he doesn't expect that level of kavod. Then they do it. So you say to yourself, well, why is this extraordinary behavior on their part? And you kind of conclude, probably. You know, if a person does something that he doesn't have to do, okay. But then we come to the second case, which is where they don't do it. And then the rabbi gets angry. So, obviously, it was something that he expected. And if he expected it, there was probably reason for that expectation. So I think it's a good way to do the story. Second time we see the story, of course, we don't see the people who stand up. There's just one person, and he just doesn't do it. So they go nicely together, I think, the two incidents.
And just what he said, the two rabbis that stood up, weren't they great rabbis on their own?
Yep.
So the indication was if they could stand up, I mean, and they had all the honor on their own, then everybody should have stood up.
Correct. And that was, in effect, what the master, the older rabbi, was saying, is these rabbis are rabbis, those rabbis are not rabbis. Mm-hmm. That's a forceful way that he says it. Yeah.
What if you
don't know, okay, that somebody is due a stand-up. Trying to express that. Mm-hmm. Lost the words, okay. Because I noticed that at some Orthodox affairs I go to, when some rabbi walks in, some people stand up. Okay. And I'm just wondering, what if people, and they all, a lot of them look alike to me, okay, you know, how do you know which guy to stand up for? And what if you don't? Are you insulting the guy?
Well, we'll also get to that. That's going to be in the text, because there usually is whether it's your rabbi. And the definition of your rabbi, some rabbis are everybody's rabbi. Some rabbis are great enough so that they are supposed to be everyone's, and we're supposed to know that. And if we don't know it, then it's our fault. You know, you sort of have to follow the crowd. In other cases, where you'll have people, you don't necessarily stand up for the other guy's rabbi. So it depends, in a way, what level of status the rabbi has. The rabbi in his community, that community should show that respect, because that rabbi is the rabbi of that community. But it doesn't necessarily follow that somebody from that community will show that level of respect to the rabbi of the next community. Okay? Okay, we go on. Amar Ravashi, Ravashi says, Afilu lemandamar harav shemachalo kvodo kvodomachul. Even for the person who says that the rabbi who forgoes his honor is forgone, Nasi shemachal al kvodo en kvodo machu. If the Nasi, I'll translate that in a moment, forgoes his honor, he can't do that. Nasi is a combined intellectual political leadership. Like Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. Rabbi Judah, we translate Nasi there as the prince. Rabbi Judah the prince. Right? Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, the head of the Sanhedrin, was usually called the Nasi, but it also implied a certain level of secular status as well. So here, the Nasi is not allowed to forgo his honor. Ma sebe Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Yoshua, Rabbi Tzadok. Oh, there's a meteve, I'm sorry. It's an objection now to what we have just read in the Braita. A story concerning Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Yoshua, and Rabbi Tzadok. Shayu mesubim bevet amishte beno shel Rabban Gamliel. They were literally sitting down but reclining at the celebration for the son of Rabban Gamliel. So Rabban Gamliel's son got married. Now some of this language is very important to pay attention to here. Are you misubim? Where have you seen that?
Pesach.
Pesach, okay, it's coming. It's coming. So kulanu misubim. You can see here, this is an excellent example of where the word came from, and the language to Misubim bevet hamishte, sort of like the pub, but a pub is not the right imagery here. The direct imagery is the Greek imagery. Greek imagery is where people would sit around as a symposium, where they would sit around go over to the Metropolitan Museum of Art. You'll see the couches where this was done. People would lean on the couch, table would be placed in front of them, and there would be a cup of wine. Conversation would take place, and people would drink the cup of wine. There would also be some grapes or some food that would be placed on the table as well. That is the picture of the Passover Seder. In the translation, the Hebrew translation of Plato's Symposium, Plato is one of the great, great dialogues of Plato was the Symposium. You know how it's translated into Hebrew?
Hamishteh.
It's called Hamishteh. Right, Hamishteh. So that is the language of the Gemara right here. This is exactly the language of the Gemara.
I was wondering why they translated it as Hamishteh.
But here it is. It's right from this. Because you can see then, these rabbis, Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Yoshua, these are people of the second century CE. So they're obviously functioning in that milieu, in the Roman Greek milieu, where they are engaging in this type of social intercourse. So they are at the wedding festivities of the son of Rabban Gamliel. Vayar Rabban Gamliel omed umashke aleihem. Right? Rabban Gamliel stood by them and was pouring. Now, mashke probably means water or the wine. I don't know. If it's a mishte, probably it's wine. And he's pouring the wine. Natana kos la Rabbi Eliezer. He gave the cup to Rabbi Eliezer, velona talo. But Rabbi Eliezer didn't take it. Natano la Rabbi Yoshua vikiblo. He offered it to Rabbi Yoshua, who did accept it. Now keep in mind, this is Rabban Gamliel. Rabban Gamliel was not only the rabbi, but the nasi. He was a nasi. He was the head of the Sanhedrin. Okay? So here we have an example which is different from the previous examples, because we are dealing with someone of yet higher status. He's the nasi. So one of the rabbis accepts the cup, the other one won't accept the cup. Right? Because the issue is, if the nasi wishes to forgo his honor, are you allowed to accept that? So, Ama lo Rabbi Eliezer. Rabbi Eliezer says to Rabbi Yoshua, Maza Yehoshua, what are you doing? Right, now, what did Yehoshua do? Look back again, okay?
He took the cup.
Rabbi Yehoshua is the one who took it.
Maybe this is where it all began, the problems between the two of
them. Correct, okay. Maza Yehoshua, Anu Yoshvin, Rabban Gamliel, Rabbi Omed, Umashke Aleinu. We're sitting, and Rabban Gamliel, the son of Rabbi Judah the prince, he's standing and he's giving us drink. Amar le Rabbi Yoshua says to him, Matzinu gadol mimenu. We have a source of somebody who is greater than he. Shishimesh, who served others. And who is that? Avraham Gadol Hadoraya. Abraham was the leading person of the entire generation. The Chatuv Bo, and it is written regarding Abraham, Vahu Omed Alehem. He stood over serving the angels who came to visit him. Alright, so here we have an example from Abraham, that Abraham, who was even greater than Rabban Gamliel, he stood and served other people. Okay? The Shema Tomru Kemalachei Asharet Nidmulo. Perhaps you will say that, well, these were not people who were there, but they appeared to him like ministering angels, and therefore there's no analogy here. That, of course, you have to treat angels differently than you treat people. You have to forego your honor to the angels. Lo nidmu lo ela la'arviyim. They didn't seem like angels, but they only seemed like Arabs. Great. It's a fantastic story. It's just that this is just one of the great stories in the Gemara. Just so yeah, it's so real. Okay, lo nidmu lo ela la'arviyim. They didn't look like angels. They just looked like Arabs. That's all they were. Va'anu lo yehe Rabban Gamliel b'Rebbi omed u'mashke aleinu. So shouldn't we not allow Rabban Gamliel, the son of Rebbe, to wait upon us and serve us drink? Right. So, in other words, if Abraham could do it, he's at yet a higher status. So why shouldn't we allow Rabban Gamliel to do it? Amar lehem Rabbi Tzadok. Remember, there was a third rabbi there. We didn't have him. He hasn't been involved in the conversation yet. So Rabbi Tzadok says, Ad matay atem menichin kvodo shel makom. How long will you ignore the honor of God? In other words, what are you talking about the honor of Abraham? Look here. Look at God. And you're trying to draw analogies from the honor of human beings. Learn from God himself. HaKadosh Baruch Hu Mashiv Ruchot. The Holy One, blessed be He, causes the winds to blow. Umale Nesi'im. And the... Well, here it says Male Nesi'im. Causes the clouds to rise. Doesn't say that. Male, He is the one who raises up princes. Umorid Matar. And He causes the rain to fall. Umatzmiach Adama. And He causes the ground to sprout. Ve'orech shulchan lifnei kol echad ve'echad. And He sets the table before every living thing. After all, God spends all of His time as a waiter, setting up everything for all of us. All the, no, that's not from Psalms, but this notion is in the 104th Psalm, that God causes all of this to happen, and God sets it all up and provides every living thing with food. So, if God does that, what's the big deal about Rabban Gamliel doing that? You know, if God does it, he forgoes His honor. Va'anu lo yehe Rabban Gamliel b'ribi omedu mashke alenu. You don't think, therefore, that Rabban Gamliel should be able to serve us food and drink? If God serves us food and drink day in and day out, surely Rabban Gamliel can do it too. So you should then accept. So here you see that even the Nasi is in fact permitted to forgo the honor that's coming to him. Which was not intuitively what I would have thought at the beginning of the discussion. You know, intuitively I would have thought that the political leadership somehow is beyond that. Okay? But you'll see there's going to be yet another, there will be an exception. Okay? Having said all of this, Ela, Itamar, Hachi Itamar. But if the statement, so now the Gemara is going to, now that we know what the law is, the statement that created an exception to the general rule was not stated correctly, the Gemara says. Hachid, iyetamar, achiyetamar. If it was said, this is how it was said, Amar Ravashi, Ravashi said, Afilu laman diamar, nasi shemachal al kfodo. Even the one who says that a nasi who forgoes his honor, that honor is to be renounced, melech shemachal al kfodo ein kfodo machul. A king who forgoes his honor, that we do not accept. That we do not accept. Shinemar, as it says, Som tasim alecha melech. You must put a king over you. So the force of Som tasim is not that you have to have a king, but when you have a king, you have to treat your king like a king. Right? That's the force of Som tasim alecha melech. And so finally concludes, Shetehe emato alecha. Som tasim means that his fear should be upon you. So in other words, there should be a way of relating to sovereign authority which is different than all other things. And the Torah itself then gives warrant for that by its formulation of Som Tasim Alecha Melech. Again, it's not just that there must be a king, because it's not clear that there has to be a king. But when there is a king, you have to make sure that you treat the king as a king, that his ema, his fear, his, the terror, sort of the frightening nature of the status of the sovereign is something that you have to respect. Okay? That, by the way, is true even in our society. I can tell you a story. My first job after the seminary, and an odd job, I worked for the United Jewish Appeal. This was 1971. And in 1971, I had this interest, it's an odd job, but an interesting job. I was the associate director of the Rabbinical Advisory Council of National UJA. It's a group of, a piece of UJA in those days, it's not the same today, where UJA tried to relate to the rabbinate in general in America. So they had, had two rabbis on staff whose job it was to deal with the rabbinic community of America. So I was just out of school, and I was assisting a rabbi who had been in the field for many years. And for me, it was very interesting because suddenly I learned a lot about the American Jewish community. That was my job. I hadn't done that kind of work before. I was sort of more of an academically interested person. I just happened, for a variety of reasons, to have that as a position. That was 1971. 1971, that was the year when Russian immigration became a significant force to Israel. 1971. And the Russian immigration was actually very difficult to figure out how to deal with. On the one hand, the Jewish community had been pushing for almost a generation to try and achieve immigration of Soviet Jews. Once we were finally able to achieve it, the problem was that we couldn't pay for it because it was an extremely expensive thing to be able to pay for. You know, these things don't just happen. In those days, remember that year, I went to the AIPAC meeting in Washington. I was representing UJA. And I go to the AIPAC meeting in Washington, and it was AIPAC's the lobby organization for the State of Israel in Washington. And in those days, Washington, the American government gave next to nothing to Israel. Next to nothing. Peanuts. So we had this amazing idea that the U.S. government should give money to Israel. Of course, over the years, the U.S. government gives a fortune to Israel. So that was became a major piece of the development of the State of Israel and became a major negotiating issue in the Israeli-Egyptian the treaty between Israel and Egypt. But in those days, there was just no money around. There was no money. And what we had to pay for was the Jews would get on the train in Moscow or in Leningrad, and they would either get on a train or a plane, but usually it was a train, and they would go to Vienna. And from Vienna, there would be planes, El Al and other airlines were flying people from Vienna to Tel Aviv. So we had to put up people in hotels. There was a castle. There was a Viennese castle, which we were renting. And we had to pay for this tremendous amount of transportation. Food, clothing, all of these things, let alone when they finally got to Israel. So we needed a tremendous amount of money for this. So you figure the thing that you would do is you go, you have a news conference, you go to the New York Times, you tell them that this is happening, you get a front page story. The problem was that the Russians were then building the Aswan Dam in Egypt. And the Russians said, if you get this word out, the Egyptians are going to kick us out of Egypt. And if that happens, we will stop the immigration. So the Jewish community was then faced with the question of what to do. So they turned to the rabbis. And they said to the rabbis, we can't promote this in the media. You guys have to do it quietly with your congregations. So the Israeli Minister of Absorption was then a man named Pellet. I don't remember his first name, but he's Sar Pellet. Lovely man, Shomer Tzair.
Who's he Pellet?
I don't know. Not the general. I think Uzi Pellet was the general. This was a Shomer Tzair kibbutznik who was the Minister of Absorption. We decided that he would make a tour of America. And so my job was to go with this minister all around America. So the question that I had was, this is a man who was Shomer Tzair Kibbutz. You know what Shomer Tzair is? There's a communist. Communist. It's a communist. It's sort of, you know, that kind of a person. Question was, should we fly tourist class? In those days, there was no business class or first class. So I went to my superiors and I said, what kind of a ticket do we buy? I had to buy the ticket. So he said, you fly first class. You don't treat a minister of the State of Israel like a tourist. So I remembered the Gemara. And that was the Gemara. Even the communist minister of absorption had to be, because it was not his choice. It was not his choice. He was the minister of the sovereign State of Israel and had to travel as was appropriate. So whenever I've been on a flight, and they will, sometimes once I was, I remember several years ago, when he was still alive, Yitzhak Rabin was on the flight. So I get on the flight, and I'm sitting in the tourist class, and the purser comes on and says, Hebrew, ladies and gentlemen, you know, I want to tell you that we are very honored to have on this flight the Prime Minister of the State of Israel. So everybody stands up. So it was just such an exciting thing. But that's how it should be, because sovereignty must be respected. Sovereignty is so, you know, so important that sovereignty takes precedence over other things. And I found that, as I just told you, that it wasn't only the melech, even in the modern state, that was important. I think even in a country like our country, I mean, how would you feel if the president of the United States were not treated properly? You know, the president could be a little bit machur, he can mochel al kvodo a little bit. He tries to do that. You know, these days, presidents have to show they're presidents of the people. But there are limits. There are limits because at a certain point you degrade the office. And we all expect whether, you know, the person is less important than the office is. And the office we expect to maintain its dignity. Okay? Yes.
I'm sorry, I want to go back to something that was said before. The term Aravim is not to be understood in today's meaning. It had an entirely different meaning in those days.
What did it mean?
It meant the people from the land of the evening, to translate it freely.
But that didn't mean anything. What does that mean?
You mean west.
I think what Aravim means, they're a Bedouin, basically.
Yes.
In the Talmud, in a pre-modern reality, Aravim means Bedouin, because in the land of Israel, who lived there? You know, nomads. It was a land of nomads.
Well, King Herod had troops of sorts. I don't know the exact duty they had, that were Aravim. A whole section of his protection.
And things haven't changed. We still have Bedouin units.
Yeah,
in Israeli
army. Citizens of certain countries.
Yeah, well, of course, that's different. That's different. Yes.
In terms of honoring a king, but it still seems like a king should be able to renounce the honor for the same reasons that Rav Tzedak gave, that God can renounce, so why shouldn't the king be able to renounce? Now, I don't think that takes away from the idea that you would honor a king.
I think the reason is, first of all, I explained it to you in a very long-winded way, for very practical reasons. I think that the practical reality makes a lot of sense. That having been said, they don't make that argument, but rather they give you a biblical verse. So I think that from the perspective of the rabbis, they understood this. Both it was implicit to them, it was obvious, just given the reality. And number two, they saw it as supported by scripture. They needed a scriptural verse for it because of the other examples that we had before. Yeah.
have an answer, a slightly different answer.
Okay.
I mean, it can't be that the king is more important than God.
Correct.
You know, or king even is more important than the rabbi. I think that, in a way, the king is more needing, more... he needs the honor more because the position is almost dependent upon the people's respecting it. He can lose it if the people lose their respect for the king. But you can't lose your respect for God. You can't really lose your respect for the rabbi. It's inherent in them. They've earned it. They've reached a position. But the king is a weaker position. It's kind of like it's conferred upon the king for whatever reason. Right?
I think the best example of that is actually coming up next week. It's read the Megillah. When you see the nature of Ahasuerus and the way in which Ahasuerus wields power. It's actually a power issue. Ahasuerus is a rather weak despot, but nonetheless does what he can to wield his power, and he's sensitive to lack of power. That's part of the reaction against Vashti, that she shows that he doesn't have power by her nerviness, her unwillingness to abide by his will. And then even the description of how he, well, even that the initial opening of the story where he invites everybody to a mishteh, same thing you're talking about, a mishteh, invites everyone for 6 months, he has a party. Why does a king have a party for 6 months? And the king says that you don't... You can have as much as you want to drink, but you don't have to drink just because we're giving it out. An interesting detail in the Megillah. And probably the reason is that you usually have to do what the king says. But in a way, I don't know whether he's a buffoon king or a weak king, he curries favor with people. He really curries favor with people. He opens up the palace, he opens up the wine cellar in order to make himself popular. Ultimately, what the king is trying to do is to rule. But some people rule better than other people do. And I think that the image you have of Ahasuerus is, again, an image of somebody trying to rule. In trying to assert the power of leadership, but in an inept fashion. But still he does it. Because a king has to do it. King has to do it because that's his job, his role. Probably the society needs the king or somebody like the king. And probably he also really wants to do it. But it's not necessarily given to him. So I think you're right.
God is Melacham HaMelachim.
Well, that's God, right? That's God. But we don't have a verse. Saying that God's in the special... all the things that we see are that God is a servant. And that's the demonstration here, that God, in fact, does serve. So God is an exception. And I think what Henry is saying there, God doesn't need that. And the king is in the less secure position, and the king therefore really needs it. Okay, good. Okay, we go on. Gone a little bit further, and we're going to begin a new subject now, which is not an unrelated subject, but it's not the same subject. First, take a look in the English of the Gemara here, 32b2, left-hand side of the page, just the first full paragraph. We're going to read an analysis of another verse in Parshat Kedoshim. We had one verse so far, which is Ish Imova Aviv Tirao. A man should revere his mother and his father. Okay, that was in Parshat Kedoshim, the book of Leviticus, chapter 19. Now we're a little further down in the chapter, toward the end of chapter 19, chapter 19:32, the Torah reads as follows. Nipnei seiva takum ve'adarta penei zaken ve'areta me'elokecha ani Hashem. That's the verse. I'll translate. Before seiva. Seiva would translate as white hair. Before white hair, takum, you shall rise up. You shall stand. You shall rise up. Ve'adarta. And you shall... How would you translate hadarta?
Respect.
Honor, respect. Or, I'll translate it for a moment extremely literally. You shall make beautiful. Because hadar is beautiful. Okay? So, there is some act of beautifying another person, which is an act that we normally in English refer to as respect or honor. But I just wanted to make it clear that we're actually dealing with a different word than the words we've used before. The word that we used earlier this evening is hidur. This is the source for hidur. And I like to remember that the word hadar means beautiful. So I think that that's what's involved. We saw when we used the word fear that it's a problem in English. Revere is sort of a problem, because it's skirting around something that's a little bit, it doesn't fit into our language so well. Hidur is yet something different. Hidur is different. It's simply not the same word. So we're now onto a third verb. It's not kavod, kibud, kabed, honor. It's not yira, fear or revere. It's hidur, which we tend to translate as honor. But it really doesn't mean honor. It means to make beautiful.
How does that differ from yafeh? Be beautiful. Is there a different type of beauty that
yes.
you're talking about?
Hadar is a more majestic beauty. A more artistic beauty.
Formal beauty.
More formal beauty.
More majestic.
Mm-hmm.
It's also citrus.
It's hadar. That's correct. Because it's a beautiful fruit. All right, Eitz Pri Hadar, the fruit of a beautiful tree. Okay?
Where at the end of a concert, when everyone's standing clapping his hand, in Hebrew it's Hadran.
Well, that's interesting. That may be different.
Encore.
Eid Dalet Reish Nun. The question, that's in the Talmud too. And it's not clear what it means. It could be that it's Aramaic. And that's what it's used in Hebrew, because hadar in Aramaic means chazar. Chazar in Hebrew. To repeat. Repeat. Encore. That's the same as encore in French, actually. We borrow it from French. So it's not clear what hadran means. Some say it means hadran meaning beauty, and the nun at the end is Hadrenu, our beauty. It's an Aramaic ending. Or it may mean the Aramaic, it may be an Aramaic and not Hebrew. Okay?
Today it's a Hebrew, but...
Yeah, today it's a Hebrew because they borrowed it from Aramaic.
Right.
Okay? Okay? So this is the verse. Now keep in mind what is being said by this. This is the source of honoring the aged. We have a separate mitzvah which requires a certain response to the old. When we say Mivnesei Vatakum, in an Israeli bus, for example, in the front of the bus, it says Mivnesei Vatakum. In other words, get up for the elderly. Right? It's a quote from Leviticus 19. That's the way you say it. So this is to honor the elderly. And Pnei Zaken, what is a Zaken?
Old.
somebody who is old? A zakan.
Is a beard.
Is a beard.
Yeah, everyone used to have a beard at that time.
Correct. So, well, that's not so simple. You're right. You're right. So just that fact may make us wonder a little bit, who is a zakein? But that would be somewhat affected by the first part of the verse. The first part of the verse says, mipnei seva. Seva means white hair. Seva means white hair. So it would be the beard of the person who has white hair. Right? That's the understanding. Or the zakein would be the one who has white hair. Maybe. Maybe. Okay? Now, we're going to take the Baraita. We'll just take the beginning of this Baraita. Tanu Rabbanan, the rabbis taught, Mipnei Seva Takum, you shall get up before the white-haired. Normally translated as the elderly. Yachol afilu mipnei zaken ashmai. Does this apply as well to an old person who is an ashmai? Rashi says ashmai means somebody who's a rasha. Somebody who's a rasha. Right? A rasha, wicked. Does this apply to somebody who is old and wicked? So in other words, is it simply the age that's crucial here? Or is it the age, and at least if certain people are disqualified because they're wicked people? Or do we have to treat all of the old alike? According to Rashi. Yachol afilu mipnei zaken nashmai. You might have thought that the verse applies even to the old person who is wicked. Talmud lomar zaken. Therefore, the second part of the verse comes and says zaken. What does that mean? The ein zaken ela chacham. And the word zaken must refer to somebody who is wise. Shenemar, as it says, Esfa li shivim ish miziknei Yisrael. Gather together for me 70 men who are the elders of Israel. Elders, by definition, are wise. So here we see something very interesting, that in Hebrew, and to some extent in English, but to a lesser extent, the word zaken actually has two meanings. The word zaken means somebody who is old, and the word zaken means somebody who is an elder. And what we will see is that we will have to wonder about whether an elder has to be old. Or is an elder somebody who is wise? And who is wise?
And all of them can be ashmai too, by the way.
It could be. It's possible. It's possible. It's possible. Okay. So that is going to be the problem. The problem that, first of all, we've set up a question. What we may be saying as a result of the Baraita so far is that if the elder is not wise, then the elder doesn't get the honor due to the old. So that in order to receive honor, to deserve the honor, it's not enough to be old. But you have to be old and wise. Okay? But there's a problem with that. And we'll turn to that next week.
Thank you.
Just a question of what you said on the Megillah. Ahasuerus, I always thought with Xerxes, was that...
Yes, Artaxerxes.
Yeah,
Artaxerxes.
But Xerxes, in history, was a very powerful king.
Well, there's several Xerxes among other.